The time is 12:52 a.m. Ready. Welcome to the W2EL repeater. The time is 12:53 a.m.
W2CDL. I think I fixed it.
The time is 12:54 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2EL repeater.
Wake up my partner in the back. He wouldn't like that either. and it's my typical Monday morning. This is the end of my work week. I wind up Monday morning and start up again tonight. I dropped off one trailer in Melville, another one in Farmingville. Now just bobtailing back, so a little bit of a rough ride this way. And truck handles a lot better when it's got some weight on the back end. But the expressway's fairly smooth out here, so it's not too bad.
I take it from what you're saying that you're driving one of the 18 mil rigs, and you have the sleeper cab back there. The partner's taking the opportunity to try to get some sleep.
And that's correct. That's correct. He left Louisville, Kentucky yesterday about 2:45 in the afternoon, and he drove to Charlottesville, Pennsylvania, which is exit, I think, 23 off of I-78 in Pennsylvania. And then I took over from there. That was his 10-hour stint. And I took it from Charlottesville out here and home again. So I don't have a full 10 hours on this leg, but we rotate every week to make it even. So it's not, it works out.
You guys, by DOT regulations, have a maximum number of hours you can be at the wheel, if I remember correctly.
That's correct. Once we come on duty, after having at least 10 hours off, or if we have 34 hours off, like we do between when we get back in Friday morning and leave Saturday night, 34 hours off or more resets all of our clocks. 10 hours off resets our 11 and 14 hour clocks. And they run once you come on duty from either 10 hours in a sleeper berth or 10 hours off at home, whatever, when you show up for work and you start to work, you cannot drive more than 11 hours in a 14-hour window from when you started working. So if you came on and were on duty for 3 hours and then started driving, you could drive for a full 11 hours, or you could drive for 6 hours, take an hour off, or an hour on duty, and still go another five. And without passing, that's 14. But if you have more time off, or even if you take a break in the middle, a sleeper bunk, it does not stop your 14-hour clock. So you're limited to a maximum of 11 hours, and you can't go past the 14-hour window. Driving-wise, you can be on duty past the 14-hour window. But once you go off duty or in a sleeper berth, you have to be there for 10 hours before you can come back driving again.
So in every 24-hour cycle, once you start going on, you got to be in the sleeper berth for 10 hours. Okay. So that's how the long haul guys do it, where they go cross country, two guys in the truck, one in the sleeper berth, one behind the wheel, and every 10 hours they rotate, I guess.
That's correct. Yeah, if you're doing TM operation, you can actually drive 14 hours out of any one 24-hour period. But that's just the way it rotates around, and the way the different clocks run. We're also limited to no more than 60 hours in 7 days or 70 hours in 8 consecutive days. And if you watch those hours carefully, you don't have to have a 34-hour reset to start. We'd probably run out of hours with the way we run it, so we need that restart. And they're trying to change the DOT rules again and force everybody into a mandatory restart. But it's this crazy way that they're wording it. They want you to have 34 hours off, but with two consecutive midnight to 6 hours off. So they're pretty much stating when your time off has to be. And that's not going to work with scheduling.
Well, to a certain extent, I can understand DOT wanting to enforce these rules. Having a trucker on the road with lack of sleep is not the safest of things.
I agree with you there, but the way the laws are written right now, they actually encourage sleep driving while drowsy, because, like I said, that 14-hour clock doesn't stop. Let's say I start driving and I've only put in 5 hours, and let's assume that whether I have a partner or not, but I need to take a 3-hour break. I can't sleep for 3 hours and then come back and finish my shift. It doesn't stop the clock. They keep on running. And the way some of these companies set up these runs, you know, you have to do X number of miles in a certain amount of time. You have to get the loads there on time. Some businesses, they have a set time when you're supposed to arrive at the loading dock. And if you get there late, they make you wait sometimes up to a whole day or a couple hours, and, you know, you're going to run out of time. So the way the laws are written right now, it's not conducive to stopping in the middle. If you're tired, you have to keep on pushing through. And that's not a good thing. I mean, the driver should be the one to determine when he needs to rest and when he's had enough rest.
I don't know. I guess it after a while you get used to it, but taking a rest period in that sleeper berth in a moving, bouncing truck cab, I don't know how much sleep I would get.
KTUPS. It does take a little getting used to. And it took me, I guess, a few months at the beginning before I really could go back there and become unconscious and sleep really good. And now it's really no problem. I actually have more trouble sleeping at home where it's quiet and the bed's not bouncing around. I need noise and distractions to kind of like lull me to sleep now. So I guess I got too used to it. But it's not for everybody. Some guys come out here to try it and they give it up because they can't handle sleeping back there and they can't handle 10 hours behind the wheel.
Well, driving one of those rigs is not the same as driving a passenger vehicle, so I couldn't say whether or not I could handle 10 hours behind the wheel. The seats are contoured differently, the physical nature of it. I don't know if I could do it.
The three tractors that I've driven over the years, they get new ones about every 3 years. We had Freightliner, Columbia's Century class. They were fair. Then they went to International ProStars. Those things drove like Cadillacs. And now we're in Volvos. And these drive pretty decent. The seats aren't the greatest, aren't the best that I've sat in, but they're still pretty comfortable. Air ride seat. So it's cushioned pretty well. The one seat I would love to try, but I know the company would never go for it, is made by Bose Technologies. It uses magnetic damping, and it literally reduces almost 100% the bumps and vibrations that you would normally feel from the road. I saw a demonstration. I think it's on YouTube. If you look up Bose seats or Bose seating or Bose truck seats or something like that, I believe there's a YouTube video on it where they have a panel, and instead of mounting a seat on it, they were bouncing a basketball. And because it's magnetic, obviously it's electrical, and it's the computer circuitry involved also. And a guy was bouncing the basketball on this metal plate that was attached to the seat dampening mechanism. And when they turned the mechanism on, you would have thought the basketball had Velcro on because it just went down and stuck to the plate. The plate absorbed all of the impact.
Interesting. That could save some of your lower back from impact after a while. Yeah, how's those cabs as far as noise reduction? Because from the passenger side car, those big diesels make a lot of noise.
The inside of the compartment here is not too bad. And again, it depends on the make and the condition of them. The longer they're on the road, the more they start to loosen up and develop rattles and stuff. But engine noise isn't too bad. I mean, I'm on the LIE now doing 63, moving with traffic. And of course I got a noise canceling microphone, which is helping. But my partner and I can have pretty much normal conversation up here if we're both awake. It's not too bad. Some of them are noisier. And then of course you get the hot rod truckers, some of their like standing gravel guys and huge 700 or 800 horsepower motors and no mufflers on the exhaust. That gets a little bit ridiculous. But we have the engine brake that we have on this tractor is quiet enough that you really don't even hear it. You feel it slowing the vehicle down, but it's relatively quiet in here.
Yeah, and I guess for reasons of communications with the office, you've got all sorts of radio equipment in there, not just the ham radio that you installed.
Actually, the only radio, the two radios, one is just the AM/FM broadcast for receiving. My partner has an 11-meter radio, which I don't touch, and he doesn't really use it either. It's just if we hit a lot of traffic and we want to find out what the holdup is, we'll get on. But other than that, it stays off. It actually covers part of the 10-meter band, but it doesn't go up into the 10-meter FM, so it doesn't do splits, so it's kind of useless for me. And as far as ham radio goes, I'm just coming in through Echolink, through my cell phone. I never mounted any HF or VHF, UHF gear in here. I probably could, but I'm too afraid of the car washes to bust the antennas off. They're good for that, to keep breaking our satellite antennas off.
I know I've talked to some people over the years that they say they've got computer hookups in their trucks so they can get information from the main office. That probably has some sort of telephone hookup through the truck and not your own personal cell phone.
We have one of those units made by Qualcomm. They can send us text messages through it, but we don't have any voice capability through it. I think the machine actually has that capability, but that's not turned on for us. They basically just send our schedule through. Our dispatch comes through on that board, so they know when we've arrived at a building what loads you picked up. We input the trailer numbers, equipment number, that kind of stuff. And I believe they can track us through GPS with that device also. And they're fine-tuning it a little bit more. They used to not track the brown trackers too closely, but they just upgraded the system they put in there that has GPS, and they can get real-time tracking on any of the vehicles in the fleet. A lot of my fellow drivers aren't too happy about that.
Yeah, the GPS tracking, Big Brother is watching. And the dispatcher, if they really want to know where you are, they can figure it out.
Yeah, but it doesn't bother me. The tracking doesn't bother me at all because I'm not doing anything out here that I shouldn't be. The guys that scream the most about it are the guys that want to pull over and, you know, park for half an hour and get paid for it, and make a lot of donut stops, that kind of stuff, and then the loads get there late and they want to know why. So, to me, if you're not doing anything wrong, then being tracked shouldn't bother you. So, it doesn't matter. There's a company cell phone, too, that they can always reach us and, if they have to. But that very, very seldom rings. Well, fortunately, they don't bother us. They leave us pretty much our own devices. If we get delayed out here, we have to send them a text message to call them up and let them know. Most of the runs we have are fairly cold. They're not that time sensitive, but we have one, the second trip to Chicago, we have to meet a train in Willow Springs, and that train pulls out at 5:15 our time, 4:15 Chicago time. And with all the road construction now, there's a lot of times where we're getting there at 5 o'clock or 5 after 5. We're just making it. So we're trying to get them to start us like an hour earlier, but so far they don't want to do it.
Well, you keep telling them we need more time to do it. If they don't do, give you the more time, one of these days you'll miss the train. What happens then? Is it a load you got to pick up or a load you got to drop off?
KTUPS, it's loads that we're dropping off that they have to take out. They're on their way to Lenexa, Kansas. So, and we've missed the train before due to weather conditions. But usually what they do then is they either get a subcontractor to bring it all the way to Lenexa, or they'll leapfrog it out using local drivers doing 10-hour drives, 10-hour stints, or a bunch of 5-hour stints to get it out. But it does happen. But I just don't like being that tight under the gun, because I feel like they just have to stop to go and use a facility or something, and I'm like, well, gee, it's, do I do this or do I make the train? And I don't like working under that tight of a time frame. You know, I like having a little bit more leeway.
And I take it doesn't take just 2 seconds to get the load off the truck and onto the train. It takes a few minutes to do it.
It can actually happen. It's probably a fairly fast procedure. It might take me about 10 minutes to drop and separate the two trailers that I'm pulling, and they'll have shifted there. That'll bring it right over, and then they have these huge either gantry trains, movable gantry trains, or these huge kind of like a forklift trailer-like vehicle that'll actually pick the entire trailer up and put it on the flat cars. No, the physical loading and unloading doesn't take that long. But like I said, we've gotten there and had the shifter tractors waiting for us in the rail yard. So as soon as we dropped it, they immediately hooked up to it and brought it over. The rail yard is like a couple hundred yards away from where we dropped the trailer, so it's not too far. But it's a pretty neat procedure.
And is anything, I guess in that case, if you have a 15-minute window, it's technically enough time if they're sitting there waiting for you.
Oh, yeah. And when we leave New York, it's normally about a 13-hour run. And they'll say, well, what time are you going to get there? So, well, barring no delays, we'll make it 13 hours. But there's a lot of things can happen. I mean, we can have a mechanical breakdown, something with the tractor, which is not uncommon. These engines are hardly what I would call reliable. We get a lot of flat tires, blowouts. You get stuck in construction. You get stuck behind an accident. Could be weather delays. You just can't predict that kind of. They want us to be more exact. We say we can't. You know, when we get 2 hours away, I can call you with an updated ETA, that sort of thing. But I mean, I've had a flat tire a mile away from the building, you know, blow out, and I had to pull over and wait an hour for the service crew to come out and get us a new tire. I could almost see the building where I had to be. But you know, these things happen.
Believe it or not, even though I don't do it for a living, I've had to wait for one of those truck tire changers. A number of years ago, a few families got together because we were all bringing our kids to the same school, and instead of piling everything into the family cars, we rented a small truck, and on the way back with an empty box, I had a blowout in one of the rear tires. And I was stranded on the Jersey Turnpike waiting for one of those tire changing services to come and change out the tire. It was lots of fun on a rainy night.
KTUPS. Yeah, it can be a lot of fun, and they never seem to happen in convenient places. You always break down with flats or engine trouble in the worst possible place, like no safe place to pull off the road. Usually sometimes you're even like in a cell phone dead zone area, or you have to walk a quarter mile down the road to try to get a signal. I've had that happen before. It's just not fun. And that's the most recent one we had. It was on our second trip to Chicago. We ended up missing the train because it took over 4 hours for the complete repair. One of the converter dollies, which is the piece of equipment that connects the two trailers together, it has an axle and four tires on it. One of the inner tires, the tread delaminated, and it just became like swinging a chain in the air, and it reached out and grabbed the electrical line and the brake line that connected the dolly to the rear trailer, ripped them right off the trailer. Of course, that locked up my rear brakes. I was forced over to the side of the road. And the first guy came out. He didn't have a tire. He had to go back to his shop. He still didn't have a tire. But I had to call the second guy, and that took another 2 hours. So, because we got paid for the whole delay, which wasn't too bad, but we still missed the train.
So when that tire tread pulled out the electrical and other lines, did it damage the line, or are those things set up on a quick disconnect that if you pull them, they just break apart?
It did cause damage. The electric line needed to be replaced, but that just is a female plug on both ends, so he had a new electrical cord with him, and that took a two-minute fix. The brake line actually was okay, but the glad hand, it's supposed to be a quick disconnect on the trailers, and it actually ripped it off with such force, it ripped the connector off the front of the trailer, but it is a replaceable piece, and he happened to have that with him. So the first guy was able to hook up the electrical line. He's got his lights, four-way flashes on the rear of our trailer, which is important. And he fixed the brakes, and then we just had to wait for the second guy to come with the right tire. But I've had turbos blow. I had an engine block blow right at the side of the block. The oil pump went, and on a hill. it gets interesting out here.
Well, when you get a major part like that blow out on you, I would assume that means your tractor's getting towed to a shop and someone else is going to have to pick up that load, or just going to have to sit by the side of the road until you can get back to it. But that doesn't sound like something they can fix in the field.
No, it's definitely not. They'll tow us another tractor, and we'll swap all of our gear out from the bad tractor into the subtractor and rehook up to the loads and continue on our way. One time when that happened, instead of us going all the way to our destination in Chicago, they had a subcontractor bring our loads from Chicago that we normally pick up, and we met on the road halfway in between from where we were broke down and our destination, and we swapped that load there. He took all those back, and we just made a U-turn at that point and came back with the rest of the stuff. So that did happen. So we've had one team miss the train, and then they were directed to continue on to Kansas themselves. That's all right if you don't have plans for the rest of the week. It can really mess up stuff if you do. Sometimes they divert us off our regular run, but 95% of the time, every week is the same.
N2ZEB. I got some LIE traffic. I'm finally on it. I'm coming on to the LIE from the Grand Central going westbound, coming up to Junction Boulevard, exit 20. And the expressway's moving nicely. I'm actually up to 35 in this zone where it's usually very, very crawly.
Okay, I appreciate that. KTUPS. I'm just coming by Glen Cove Road now, and it's still moving fine out here. It usually backs up once I start hitting the city line, but I think we're early enough. We just might squeak into Queens, and I get off of Maurice Boulevard and head about three blocks in off of Maurice. That's where our depot is. But some days this ride can take 2.5 hours, and other days it can take just an hour. All depends on when we leave Suffolk. That's You know, sometimes even a 15-minute window out there can make a huge difference in when we finally end up in Queens.
Well, the last 2 miles of your trip on the expressway are usually the worst in that case, because that's the 2 miles that is usually backed up badly. Because I just came up to Woodhaven Boulevard and it backed down.
And that's usually the worst part of the trip, but what are you going to do? So, and if we get stuck in traffic out on the road when we're pulling loads, we get paid by the hour while we're delayed. But when we're just bobtailing like this, it's straight mileage pay. So if it takes me a half hour, it takes me 2 hours, I'm still going to get the same for this leg. But it's a short leg, so it doesn't make too much difference there. I wonder if you have any plans on visiting or shopping at Dayton, which I believe is coming up with next month, middle of the month, I think. I made one trip out there many years ago. I would love to go again.
Nah, I don't have any plans for that. That kind of stuff doesn't really intrigue me. I don't have an HF qualified license, I'm only a tech. And I don't have multiple rigs. And I'm set up here in my car nice and comfortable. I have no intention to buy anything until this thing goes. And hopefully it doesn't. And then it's just a matter of deciding which rig to buy and buy it.
It's fun to go out. I had just been licensed, I guess, about a year or two, and I decided to drive out there. I was a local ham who had made arrangements to have a room with somebody else, and that guy backed out, but there was an open room right downtown. I was like, you know what, this chance may not come by again in the near future. I wasn't married yet. You know what, let me take this trip. And it was fun just to see everything. I wouldn't want to do it every year. But it was kind of nice to see it. I'd like to go down to Maryland, to Timonium, see that ham fair sometime, too. That's supposed to be getting fairly large. And there was one up in New Hampshire, I think it's called Nearfest. That's supposed to be good, especially if you like old vintage gear. There's a lot of that stuff there.
If I still had my father's gear, I would have brought it to a ham fest to try to get rid of it that way. But when we closed up the house after he passed away, I wasn't in the hobby and hooked up with people yet. And I had all his equipment, and I said, what do I do with it? It ended up hitting the junkyard.
Oh, that's a shame. That's a real shame. Somebody could have used it, and you could have made some bucks. But, who knows? Maybe somebody still picks it up at some point. I had a couple of old boat anchor gear, pieces of gear that I had picked up at some of the line markets and ham fest. My first set of radios was a 10 set of SJC twins, 101 twins, I think. I had an old Hamelin's general coverage receiver that I used to DXDA and broadcast band at night, and that was fun. Turn it on and feel the tubes inside glowing. I think the oldest piece I have now that it needs a little bit of work, but I'd like to get it going, is a Collins military receiver. I think it's like a Model 51J, something like that. It covers pretty much continuously the low band. Nice receiver, but I would be afraid to turn it on right now that the electrolytics are dried out and stuff. It's cooking the thing, so. But that is a piece that I would like to have fixed up.
By the way, the expressway had its usual slow down bottleneck and then opened right up. My father's gear was an old Viking pacemaker, big boat anchor, And then as far as a receiver, because that was transmitter only, he had a national general broadcast receiver, and he had as an external piece what he called a sideband slicer, so he could get the upper and lower sidebands separately. And I remember sitting and watching him with all those dials on it, tuning it up for a band. I'm trying to remember, his antenna was a 40-meter trapped multiband vertical that I helped him install. I think it was by Mosby. I don't remember.
That's neat. At least it's the guy's, you know, good memories of seeing him operate. So I wonder if you pass along his call sign. I wonder if I had had the chance to come across him at any point. That'd be interesting. That old time gear, I still got a soft spot for that. You know, new modern gear is nice. Just turn it on. You know, it's going to work predominantly and fairly regularly. And it does all sorts of features, but there's still something about down in front of those old. Old radios, especially operating CW, which is my preferred method on the HF band.
I highly doubt you would recognize his call because he's been a silent key now for about 18 years.
I've been licensed for, I think, about 26. With seven. Now, was he involved with the live market at all, or any VHF stuff, or just HF?
He was never involved with live mark, but he did have 2-meter capability. All right, his call was WB2MZQ.
Crossed up with them on the low band at some point. So there's a bunch of different people that I've talked to that way. And that's one with CW. I like that over phone. It kind of makes everybody the same. You really don't. You can't determine anything from their voice. Although some guys have a very distinctive swing to their fist when they're operating. But everybody pretty much starts out the same.
Rich, I got a sign. I'm at the Midtown Tunnel. Thanks for keeping me company. You shouldn't have too much long to go. N2ZEP is clear of the frequency.
Okay, Gary, 7-3. And thanks for the company on this N2. Have a good day. K2 UPS Mobile.
W2EL repeater system. Good morning. The time is 6:56 a.m. Good morning. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Recovering from a big road trip weekend.
Okay, very good. I assume you're on your commute in.
Yep, just got on the Major D and nice blue sky. Can't say the same was true when I was driving back Saturday night up the Shenandoah Valley.
What state was that in?
Mostly Virginia, but we also hit West Virginia and Pennsylvania.
Okay. Sounds like it was, you put a bit of mileage on.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we were down at Virginia Tech, which is pretty far south in Virginia on 81. And I guess going down there, we sort of followed the American Revolution Continental Army. And as I told my wife, we came back the route of the Confederate retreat from Gettysburg.
Okay, interesting way of putting it. And what is that route exactly?
Well, I mean, going down, we sort of, went along the coast to Washington, or mostly along the coast, 95, essentially, and then headed west. That was, Route 66, or Interstate 66, out of Washington, D.C., to 81, and then hours and hours south, almost into North Carolina. And on the way back, it was 81 all the way up the spine of Virginia, along the western boundary into West Virginia and Pennsylvania, where, into Gettysburg.
Any special reason why you took two different routes, or just to do the sightseeing tour?
Well, partially to break up the monotony, partially on the way down we had to drop something off at a friend in New Jersey and sort of committed us to the Washington, D.C. route. And then on the way back, we went north, west of Washington, D.C., kind of into the belly of Pennsylvania.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me like your route coming back sounds a little longer than the one going down.
Actually, it's the opposite. I think the route we came back was probably faster and more direct.
That shows how good I know my geography at that point of the country. Okay. I'm sitting in my usual parking lot between 132nd Street and 125th Street or so. I'll back over to you.
Yeah, just to explain it maybe a little bit better, you go over the GW Bridge, go on the New Jersey Turnpike a little bit. If you take Interstate 78, through Newark, and follow it all the way. Harrisburg, then pick up 81, you go due south, all the way down to Blacksburg, which is where Virginia Tech is. You know, it's kind of a big arc, but it's more direct and certainly far less traffic than going through all the major urban centers along the coast.
So how long does the drive back take you?
Well, we broke it up because the game and the tailgate didn't really end until 4:35 o'clock Saturday afternoon. So I drove, until we hit Pennsylvania, and then we just, stayed overnight near, not far from Allentown, actually, and then got up and went into the city Sunday morning.
Okay, Allentown, I know. I've been there a couple of times. I'm just curious how long, actual traveling time, how long it took.
Well, if you Google map it, which means you're a robot, there's no traffic, and the roads are perfect, you don't have to stop. You can do the trip in just under 9 hours. But, being human, it does take a bit longer.
Oh. Okay, that's more than my tolerance level, that's for sure. 8 hours or so is about my max. I don't know. I shouldn't say that again. We had a few years ago, we had a wedding in Toronto, and we drove up, we went to the falls, that's like 2 days there, and we swung up to Toronto, but actually, Toronto on the way back, I mean, we stopped back at the falls for a couple of hours, but other than that, and then we stopped in Corning, see the Corning Museum over there with the glass blowing and all that stuff, show the kids. So we did make a couple of stops, but other than that, we basically drove straight back. But that with the stop probably was about 12 hours. 12, 14 hours, I don't know, whatever it was. I don't even remember it. So, back to you.
C2CAP Mobile.
Good morning, Ron. Anyway, I was just recapping my Road Warrior trip from the weekend down to Virginia Tech. And Navit was the last lacrosse game. So, certainly, the parents of the seniors were all there, and, we all had a good time. That was nice. And we all considered flying, particularly from New York and points north, but it's ridiculously expensive. And, you had to fly to North Carolina or some other place not particularly close. And you still had to rent a car, and it was a major to do if you didn't drive. So there weren't too many choices. Anyway, Ron, you take it and give it to Nat.
South Carolina, That's the end of the month, the end of May. And then they have one next week in Las Vegas. And it was easier, cheaper, and less time to go to book Las Vegas than to go to South Carolina.